on 4th August 76 in Groningen. Now, you began as a graduate student in the Caltech group, I believe, is that right? In connection with radio astronomy, anyway. Or?
Yeah, I got there in the summer of 56, I guess. And at that point, they just had a 30-foot dish at Palomar. It's before Owens Valley got really going.
Right.
And for about a year, that was the main instrument. And we kept that running. It had two, what they call Stanley steamers.
I haven't heard that term.
Gordon Stanley had these locked oscillators. There were two local oscillators. And then a scanning second oscillator, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. And several of us would go down on weekends or whatever, or during the summer. And we did 21 centimeter observation. It would take about an hour for a scan. And we were just doing hydrogen line in the galactic plane, essentially.
Now, was this really sort of killing time until Owens Valley came along?
Or? Well, it was mainly, I think, to get something moving more than killing time.
Because there was not a big instrument available? But...
Yeah, it takes time to get the whole thing in Owens Valley built.
Right. And when you said we, who was working with you on this? I see it's Bolton, Stanley, and you published a paper in 58 on this survey.
Yeah, we divided the plane into two pieces, and Tom Matthews and somebody else had one piece, and then we were working on the other piece as far as reductions go. Mm-hmm. June Matthews was there too at that time, that summer. I think it was the summer of 56. She's Shapley's granddaughter. Do you know her?
No, I didn't know that. Yeah, I know her. I was a graduate student in Maryland. And, I don't know her. I didn't realize that.
And what's his name was there? Who had done his undergraduate work at Caltech. And then he went to Harvard, I think, after that. But he was there the same summer. He's now at Lockheed.
Oh, the fellow does H2 readings, H-alpha. It'll come to me. Anyway, he was working on this 21 centimeter stuff also?
Yeah, everybody was doing that in the beginning. And I say Tom Matthews. I think Jim Roberts hadn't arrived yet.
Do you think that anything useful scientifically came out of this hydrogen work?
No, I don't think so. I've never done any more line work really since then. But it was, it was educational and it was reasonable at the time.
It was instructive for the group anyway.
Yeah, and I suppose it was of use to some people, but other places were doing the same kind of thing at that time.
But Bolton and Stanley mainly were concerned at that time with getting Owens Valley going, getting the money for it, and this sort of thing, I suppose.
I actually went to California the summer before, when I was still a junior in college in the East Coast, and I went to Caltech to see if they had any job for the summer. And at that point, they didn't have anything at all running. But then when I was going to go as a graduate student, then there was an opportunity for me to work before I started graduate school. And I think that was the main thing going until for about a year and a half. It must have been in 50, pretty much in 58, before the Owens Valley got going.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So with a single dish. And it was very nice at Palomar. We used to go up to the 200-inch and have midnight lunch with Bada and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, this other chap, I can't remember the name of it, so once ate Bada's midnight lunch, and Bada was hugely upset. I don't know if you want anecdotes for this or not.
Oh, yes, anecdotes are always appreciated.
Anyway, that's where we learned to play pool. Yeah. Bolton was a good instructor in the billiard table and the 200-inch.
Do you think that this being on Palomar helped optical radio contacts at all later on when radio source identification and so forth became important?
Yeah, well, I think Minkowski and Bolton had a good working relationship. And of course, Minkowski and Bada were interested in radio sources.
Right, so that was established before the Palomar thing, the 30-foot. So, were you involved in the actual construction or overseeing of the construction of the of this first dish at Owens Valley? Or?
Not really, because I was still busy in coursework.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of thing we did, which we always interpreted as the Australian way or the English way of doing things, was we all got involved in pulling cables through the conduits and wiring up various parts of the equipment.
Right, right.
But as far as the design and the real control of what was going on, I mean, the graduate students were more schoolies.
Sure. And, that makes sense.
Yeah, and at about that time is when Radhakrishnan came and Jim Roberts was there. So after I finished my coursework in 2 years, I've been in 58, then I spent about a year at Owens Valley when there was a single dish running at 960 megahertz and it wasn't, the interferometer wasn't working yet.
Right.
The second dish hadn't been made.
Were you the only one living up there?
Yeah. Pretty much. Other people would come up for a time and then go back again. I was up there sometimes alone, sometimes, most of the time with somebody around.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you do at 960?
Well, we first started off, you know, when you have a nice new thing that wasn't that much going on at high frequencies. Most of the work had been done at low frequencies, and you sort of look at everything. And we looked at the moon,
mm-hmm.
and of course Jupiter was interesting. I remember that in the moon we found what we found, we thought to be a phase effect, that the intensity varied with the period of the moon as if it was getting hotter or cooler. And then after about 2 months of this, we realized that we had not corrected for parallax.
Oh boy.
We were using the geocentric.
So you were coming off the moon and on the moon.
Yes, yeah. Pointing was, our beam was about 48 minutes of arc. Of course, the moon was 30 minutes of arc, so it was very nice. It just worked out, so intensity varied.
Do I take it from this that your graduate courses had not been in classical astronomy so much as physics and this sort of thing? So you weren't, you weren't really astronomers so much as physicists, would you say? Or
yeah, at Caltech, most of the... Well, our time at Caltech is sort of divided between astronomy and physics. But it's something like that you read, you're exposed to once and then you forget about it.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point you realize that you knew it.
And what about the Jupiter, right? Was that work ever published? I don't...
Yeah, Jim Roberts, I think. Was
oh, that's right.
Dave Morris.
That's right.
Published some of that.
Even before the interferometer, Jupiter observations, which of course were important also.
Yeah.
And you were assisting in these observations?
Yeah, pretty much everybody cooperated. On the CTA list, which was the first, when we were trying to sort of check on the 3C list, the original 3C list, everybody did parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bolt said at a certain point, okay, you know, Harrison Roberts will work this up and publish it. And then he said, Wilson can publish the stuff in the galactic plane. And a lot of people worked on the CTA list.
I see.
And I always felt, you know, it should have been Bolton, first of all, because it was his instrument, but he was that kind of guy who would, you know, just say, okay, you guys do this and you do the other thing.
So that's the paper in 1960 in PASP.
That's right.
And what was the main result of that CTA survey, would you say?
Oh, I think it was one of the... hello!
Right, now the value of the CTA survey, would you say?
I think there were two or three, you might say, conclusions which were reasonable to come out of that. One was we sort of came to have faith in the 3C survey,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, people didn't have faith in the 2C survey.
Right.
And the next thing was that we were able to get reasonable spectral indices. And up to that time, the main thing I think had been done by Costain. And he was getting spectra, I think, between 80 and 158 megahertz, where he was finding the mean was more around 1.1 or something.
The spectral index, yeah.
Yeah, and we got a mean around 0.8, which is significantly different, so that we came to have a feeling that the whole distribution was down.
Mm-hmm.
The other most interesting or most useful aspect was that the distribution, the spectral index, was fairly narrow, say from 0.5 to 1, with the mean at 0.8. And it wasn't tremendously wide, which, of course, was of interest to because you wonder why a population of electrons has more or less the same index, a huge variety of sources.
This was not apparent from the Costain's work because of the shorter baseline and frequency. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not sure why that was a revelation to us, as it were. Costain may not have had a tremendously wide distribution, but I think maybe I'll have to look back and see what he actually said. Maybe it was much wider before that. But we were impressed with essentially how narrow it was, that it was finite, and essentially all the sources fell between 0.5 and
Would you say that the CTA survey was really the one to put the benediction, the blessing on the 3C survey as being reliable? Was that generally accepted, or was it only in your mind that it was that way? And others were accepting the 3C survey already.
Well, there was a huge competition, I think, in, between Mills and Cambridge.
Right.
And in the region of overlap, there was not tremendously good agreement.
All right. Yeah.
So that we came to have faith in the Cambridge work, and of course later we did a survey with the interferometer of Mills sources. And we find a lot of those were blends of sources.
Okay, before we get to that, you're saying there was a large disagreement even with the 3C and Mills' results. Of course, there was the...
With the 2C, there was tremendous
disagreement. There was a classic disagreement with the 2C, but also 3C?
Yeah.
It was your motivation, essentially, to see which one of those was most reliable?
I think that was the thrust, yeah.
Although you just checked 3C sources, so that really wasn't a fair way to do it. That was the motivation.
Well, to see if they were really where they said they were in relative intensities.
Right.
There were a few, of course, we knew were lobe shifted. And in fact, we found some new sources, like CTA21, when we were looking for a 4C source that wasn't there.
And a 4C source?
No, sorry, a 3C source.
Yeah.
So that, like one time, we just let the telescope run on and doing something else. And we found CTA21 that way.
I see.
Or was it 102? I guess it was 102 was found that way. And CTA21 was found when I was working with Bob Wilson on the galactic plane. I got a little bit off the plane. That's how it went, yeah.
Okay, so you worked on that and published that in 1960. I also have here that probably as a byproduct of that you did a little bit of work on Hydra A and Hercules A to get accurate positions and try to see what the optical identifications were. Is that right?
Yeah, that was sort of picking out some sources that were already known to try and get identifications because, of course, in those days there were relatively few identifications percentage-wise. I mean, now we think we know why sources are not identified, but in those days we had no idea whether it was a different kind of object or not. I think one of those was a bad identification, actually.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, but...
The idea was to get more accurate positions.
That's right.
And how were you able to do that with just a single dish? Or was that the interferometer?
No, I think that was a single dish. Yeah. But we had with a beam of 48 minutes of arc, and then you can get a position doing a few minutes of arc. Mm-hmm. And they were fairly strong sources.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, one of those was wrong, I think.
Okay, the only other thing I have here, up to including 1960, was an AVRO report with Kellerman, in which indeed you talk about the MSH radio sources looked at with the interferometer. Was that the first thing you did on the interferometer?
Yeah.
When it came along?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this was a comparison, parallel thing with the 3C check.
That's right,
But now why did you use the interferometer for the Mills and the single dish for the 3C?
Well, it was more of what was ready, at the time. The interferometer was then ready, and it was fairly quick. We had better sensitivity, and that was done much more in a hurry or as a quick project where you only spent 5 minutes on each source.
I see.
In the CTA list, we would first find the source and then measure it very carefully. with drift curves. In the interferometer, we just went on the position of the source, and if we didn't find it, we wouldn't look for it. So that, of course, we would lose sources that were resolved.
Right.
And it was much quicker, and we looked, I think, at a larger number of sources, if I remember correctly.
Was that survey published other than the internal report?
No. No, it was never published.
Was that because it was thought that you didn't really merit it since you did it?
Yeah, I don't remember what the rationale was at the time, but I mean, it's hard to have faith in your flux densities if you were resolving out part of the flux, and we didn't want to spend the time with a single dish to go back and do a careful job the way we had on the CTA.
But what were you able to conclude? I have here that you checked 739 MSH.
There were more than I do, yeah.
MSH sources. 82% of the small radio sources were found. Small underlined. But I mean, what did it tell you as far as the reliability of the MSH surveys?
I guess, you know, I mean, most of the sources were there. But I remember having a big argument with Kellerman. In fact, we even took a picture of a fight we had. But I can't remember what the thrust of that was.
You just remember the fight, okay.
I remember the picture anyway.
Right.
It was a friendly fight.
Okay, well, you said you left in 61, and what actually was your thesis work then?
The thesis was sort of on supernova remnants, but it was titled the spectral index, or study of the spectral index or something of sources, so it included the CTA work as part of the thesis, but to my mind, the thesis was mainly on supernova remnants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what sort of thing did you do in it?
Well, we looked at primarily Cygnus Loop was one of the best sources we studied. Where we built a map up by doing drift curves and tying together different...
The single dish, no?
Single dish, mm-hmm. Yeah. That was all single, because we looked at big objects. And I had the advantage that Mathewson had done the Cygnus Loop at Manchester at 400 megahertz. And his beam then had the same resolution as we had at 960, because they had a bigger dish. So we were able to make a spectral index comparison of the different parts of the Cygnus Loop. And then I also looked at several other, I think there were about 9 remnants, HB9, HB21, CTA1, which was a source we found in the CTA, which is a supernova remnant.
Mm-hmm.
And we also did Kepler and Tycho and the Crab, but of course we didn't resolve them, we didn't map those. And
you say we, who else was working?
Well, I say we generically. It was my project. So then I discussed, in the thesis I just discussed the spectra of supernova remnants. And of course, at that point I seemed to find that the spectra of the older remnants were flatter than the spectra of the young remnants, like Cass,
mm-hmm.
with the exception of the Crab, of course. And then the question if that was true, and of course it was difficult to tell because it was hard to get good frequency points for the different remnants because there weren't that many observations made at that time. We had, Westerhout had seen some at 1400, and then there was low frequency work, but they were bothered by resolution if they were interferometers.
Right.
So the temptation then was, one interpretation would just say that was an evolutionary effect, and the other possibility was that it was a difference of initial conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggested it could be evolutionary. And at that time, Shklovsky was publishing his results, his theoretical calculations, you might say.
Right.
And
how the flux would decrease with time and this sort of thing.
Yeah, and how the spectral index would change, and of course, the only known way it would change was if you get synchrotron losses and you expect it to get steeper with time, not flatter with time. So my suggestion was sort of against the conventional wisdom of the time.
Right.
And I figured it would take 20 years before you could see a measurable change in CAS, but recently, of course, they have seen a change in CAS.
Right, the Clark Lake results, are you referring to?
Let's see, there's been some 80 megahertz measurements, I think in England. Shake shaft.
Yeah. The Clark Lake.
Clark Lake has found something megahertz. Funny. They found something changing at one frequency, but not another, didn't they?
Something like that.
Yeah. That's very strange, that one. But there was some indication that the spectrum of CAS might be getting flatter about a year or two ago. That's sort of surprising, because nobody's ever believed that they really do get flatter.
So maybe you were right after all.
Yeah, it's possible, but nothing to worry about.
I wanted to ask, when you talked about the CTA survey, was it, like you say, at a high frequency? In fact, I guess it was the highest frequency all skies survey at that time. Well, it wasn't really a survey.
It wasn't a survey, no.
No, that's true. And so it didn't really bring out a new population of sources in any sense. So.
No, I mean, the sources it would have brought out are things like CTA-21, which we just found by chance.
Yeah. If you indeed just done a blind survey. Was there any thought of doing such a thing?
The sky was too big.
Too many interesting things to do. Okay, before we leave Caltech, can you maybe comment on just what it was like working in that group? It sounded like it was pretty good. People were all working together on different projects, and it was not the sort of thing where everybody was off in his own corner doing his own thing.
Yeah, the group was small enough. I think, there was only about five or... Well, eight, maybe, people. Because, there was Roberts and Bolton and Stanley, Tom Matthews, Radhakrishnan, Dave Morris. They had their degrees, of course, over various stages. Right. And there was myself. And then shortly afterwards, Moffat came in from physics. And Bob Wilson came in from physics. And then there were some more people who came in astronomy. But it was a fairly, small group.
Yeah.
I think it was a very good atmosphere. And, of course... We always laughed a bit because one always had the feeling that we were at the best place. And you couldn't believe anything anybody else did.
Right, right. One can observe this effect at many places around the world.
Mm. We continue this.
Okay, so you got your degree in 61, and then what did you do?
Then I went to Italy. The word from... Ciccarelli was that the antenna should be ready by the time I got there in the summer of 61.
Mm-hmm.
I know that everybody is always optimistic, so I arranged to go to Green Bank for a month in the fall. I arrived in Italy in December. And actually, I left Italy 2 years later, and the antenna was still not ready, and that was just that things always take longer,
right.
And sometimes much longer
than one expects. What were the troubles there?
I guess it's a different way of doing things. The people had not had a long history of, like the English in Cambridge, for example. They'd been building things themselves for years, and they were able to, they had a great deal of experience to go back upon. They knew how long things would take, and they were able to do things fairly directly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we did everything, I guess you wouldn't say the wrong way first, but we, in Bologna, we had to feel our way.
Yeah.
And just took a lot of time.
Just a lack of experience is really what you're saying.
And it was quite a small group at the same time. So that, we'd go out and line up the baselines ourselves at night. And we'd go up on the structures and the theodolite down below and measure the alignment of each individual piece of the array. And
it sounds like it wasn't a lot of money that you could just hire a surveyor to do these things either. Mm-hmm.
We had a consulting surveyor, but to my mind, he was always more in the way than a help.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the whole feed arrangement, of course, was very complicated. It was a Christmas tree type feed, and you have thousands of dipoles down the kilometer or so, the length of the thing. And then every once in a while, you build a preamplifier. But that whole system had to be designed and tested, and then manufactured by a local manufacturer. Everything just took a lot of time.
Yeah. Now, who was actually mainly responsible for the design of the instrument?
As I understood it, the The basic design came from the Benelux cross, which so had been designed here.
In Christensen, basically.
And of course, here they never got agreement between Belgium and Luxembourg
and
Holland, so that by the time they actually built something, they'd progressed further and further and completely changed the design.
Right.
Whereas the Italians took this design and said, okay, this is what we're going to do, and they went ahead and did it. It took time, but they did it.
They did it even as the Benelux cross was still being planned to be built? I mean, so they would have a very similar instrument?
That I can't say. It could be that when they took the design, it was already a cast-off. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the Mills cross was going ahead in that general direction at the same time. And I think everybody realized that it would be a good instrument, but of course, it was a fairly specific instrument.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you see as being the main novelties in the design of it, or its main uniqueness, shall I say?
Well, the east-west arm, I think, was fairly straightforward. And to my mind, looking back, there was no novelty in that. The only thing I was impressed with as far as novelty goes was when I returned in 68 for a visit, the north-south phase corrections to steer the north-south arm. It was done with coaxial line with oil on the outside. You adjust the level of the oil on slanting coaxial lines.
Yes, I remember this.
You changed the phase.
Myself.
I've never seen that. Oh, I suppose it's been used in other places, but I thought that was fairly impressive. Maybe the most novel thing was trying to get water for the site and hiring a diviner to come out with a dipstick.
is that true?
I think that's true, yes. Ciccarelli's point was that as far as he was concerned, they could dig anywhere for water, so why not have a diviner?
Increase your chances slightly.
Yeah. They also, I think, had a priest to come out and bless the antenna before it was put in operation.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There again, I think Ciccarelli's point was that it didn't really matter much. It was going to go into operation one way or the other.
Right, had nothing to lose.
Yeah. It's like he said his grandfather had never, or his father had never, been very close to the church, but when he was about to die, he said, well, send the priest in. Doesn't matter to me. If there is a heaven, that way I'll get there. And if there isn't, it doesn't matter anyway.
Right. So I gather then that this thing was not on the air.